Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to the Peristyle Podcast on a Wednesday. We're talking some USC football with our friend Dan Weber, USCFootball.com beat writer and columnist. A lot of different topics to get to. You guys have sent in a lot of questions. I know it's the off season. I know we took last week off, so questions have piled up. We got a lot to get to today. It's a packed show. If you have any questions for us, podcast at USCFootball.com is our email address, or you can call us at 424-254-9141. That's 424-254-9141. You can call, leave a voicemail, or send us a text. And we do have a text on that line for Dan today. A lot of different ways to get a hold of us, so we do appreciate you giving us the feedback for the show. If you want to subscribe, you can do it on iTunes. We have our own URL, itunes.com/Peristyle Podcast. We're on the Google Play and Stitcher Radio and Audio Boom and TuneIn Radio and all that. So a lot of different ways you can consume the show. We do appreciate all the feedback and any kind of positive reviews you could leave for us. We've been doing this since 2008, if you can believe that, talking USC football. We're going to continue that today with Dan Weber. Dan, how are you today?
Doing good. Yes. Looking for, this is probably, you know, since we've been here, for some reason, you know, you could say in some ways it compares a little bit to the year with Lane Kiffin and Matt Barkley had decided to come back and the Trojans were, you know, so highly thought of and all that. And I know, you know, looking back on it, you never felt really comfortable about a lot of that. It's just, there was just something, there's a different feeling this time, you know, it's more, well, and maybe it, you know, comes off of the Rose Bowl and the, you know, the Washington game at the end of the year. I mean, that team was coming off an Oregon win at Oregon, didn't get to go to a bowl game. So maybe that's different. And that team had Lane Kiffin as the head coach and maybe that makes a difference, that it was hard to ever feel really, you know, really solid, but you got a more solid feel about these guys. And maybe one of the other things is they're more removed from when USC was really great and maybe don't take anything for granted. Whereas, you know, closer to the Pete Carroll era, maybe it was hard to really understand what was all involved and USC getting to where USC, you know, eventually got. And looks like you've got more of a sense of this is something we really have to work hard at and, you know, get better at and compete, you know, with one another and make one another better and all that. You've got that feeling maybe with this team that there's a lot of that there. And then there's Sam Darnold factor that plays into everything. So, but, yeah, this is kind of a neat off season. Because every day you see something in some media somewhere about, you know, next season and what's going to happen or the next NFL draft or all of those things. And USC is now relevant again. There are very few of those discussions that go on that don't have USC in there in some way or another. And that's kind of neat because for a while you felt like you're on the outside looking in and that isn't that's not the case anymore.
Yeah, certainly being relevant is what, you know, USC fans, you know, obviously strive for greatness, but it's hard to be great when you're not relevant, and USC is that now. All good stuff. We want to talk about a lot of different things on the show today. Like I said, it's a packed one. You know, the kind of future of the team. Right now the team's going through finals, so it's kind of a weird off-season time. Summer workouts will be starting up, you know, fairly soon, but right now it's finals time. We, you know, still wrap up a little bit with the NFL draft. We have some questions on that. The Coliseum renovation is in full swing. We're going to talk to you about that stuff too. But before we jump into all of that, this is a little kind of side note. I'm not going to mention any names because I didn't check with this person before. I want to bring it up. But 25 years ago, this past weekend was the LA riots. And I was actually a junior at USC. It was the night before our first day of finals. It was a Tuesday night. And when everything started to go down, and Wednesday was, you know, crazy. And we had to, you know, we had to evacuate, and, you know, finals were canceled. I ended up taking one final when I got back, but we were gone for like 5 days, and right in the middle of everything. I mean, it was insane to see the helicopters were flying over. You'd see them on TV and burning buildings. And I mean, we were right in the middle, you know, ground zero of the, I think they call it like the largest civil unrest and the most destructive civil unrest in American history. So it's crazy, you know, 25 years. And I took some pictures afterwards. When we got back, one of my roommates actually went and took video that first night, and there was crazy stuff on the video, and I can't find it. I don't know who has it now with like a VHS tape video, but there was guys with guns, like burning buildings, all kinds of stuff. But when we came back, I took a lot of still photos, just walk, you know, we went, drove around campus, around the Coliseum, everything, and campus was fine, but the, all these buildings around it, like our pizza place, you know, shoe stores, all these things are just gone, you know, and they're rubble. So I took a bunch of pictures of them. I shared them on Facebook. I think it was like 5 years ago for the 20th anniversary. And I reshared it again recently. And I posted it on the Peristyle. And it's funny that people, I mean, it's not funny. It's a terrible tragedy. But the stories that came out, and there was one photo of, I think it was like a beauty salon that was burned down. And there was two women kind of going through the rubble. And you could see, you know, it's from 1992. And this woman had like real big frizzy hair and kind of a strange looking dress on. You're like, what kind of fashion is that? And I made a little comment in the Facebook thing. And, someone on the Peristyle, one of our posters, is like, those are my sisters. So from 25 years ago, he identifies his sisters who lived like right behind that building. And he told me the story. It's like, one of his sisters was like, there's all the, you know, the burning, the building was burning, and they were like, we could, there's all these products in there. Should we get it out? And she was like, can we go save those products? And her sister's like, no, you get arrested for looting. So they just kind of let everything sit there and it all kind of burned down. But it was just a strange time. But the fact that, you know, this 25-year-old photo that I shared on the message board, and one of the dudes on the Peristyle, Dan, it's like his sisters that were there checking out the rubble like we were.
That's amazing. I run into that all the time. Somehow in sports, it just seems like it cuts down the distance between people. And I can't even begin to tell you how many different times that's happened to me, you know, over my career. And it's just like, did that really happen? You know, it's just amazing. I will say this. My first time ever covering a USC game was 1988 in the Notre Dame game. And then 1989, I put together a traveling college football Hall of Fame and went, we traveled 26,500 miles all over the country. And we did do the USC-Ohio State game in 1989, and also did the USC-Notre Dame game at Notre Dame. So I got USC twice that year. And it was hard for me to believe a couple of years later that right where we were and all the places we got, that what was happening was happening. And I watched the National Geographic, if you get a chance, has a two-hour documentary.
It's really good.
A lot of video.
Really good,
that,
yeah.
That I hadn't ever seen before, and it just takes your breath away. And I know one of the saddest things that I can think of is Mark Brown, a USC guy, who's the anchor on Channel 7, was a young reporter, and he went back to this little shopping mall where he started to cover the riots. And he said there's something there that happened that will never leave him. And he said somebody had started, when they were starting, setting fires to businesses, they had set fire to this pet store. And they could hear the pets inside. You know, it was burning and nobody could get them out. And he said, that will never leave me. You know, the thought of that, the sound of that, and you know, that kind of brings you home and you think, my goodness, how did this happen? You know, 59 people killed. It's just almost impossible to imagine. You know, when you go there today and you don't even think a thing about it, pretty amazing stuff. But if you get a chance to see that National Geographic documentary, it's really worth you know, looking at.
Yeah, I checked it out. It's like 2 hours, no commercials, all footage, and there's no commentary. It's a documentary without, they're not putting their own, and some people were critical of that because there's no commentary, but just hey, this is what was going on. And they show all this footage. It's some of it's home video, but a lot of it's news stuff that was put together. It's crazy. All the bad decisions that were made. I mean, when you have a disaster like this, there's multiple bad decisions, like one after another after another. That's how something like this happens. And it was just so many in a row. And for USC to be right in the middle of it, and I remember the next year, admissions were all-time low or whatever. I mean, it was like a low of 50 years or whatever, something crazy. It was insane. I mean, we were right in the middle of this horrible, horrible, civil unrest, and it lasted for days. I mean, it was going on for days. You could see the smoke still and the National Guard and everything. I mean, you can check it out. I put those pictures up on the Peristyle, and I do apologize, but I've kind of thought about, and we're sort of doing this now, which I don't want to get into too much more, but, doing like, there's a lot of good stories on the message board. There was one story that someone said he was on a motorcycle. He jumped a curb. He would have been like taken down by rioters and beaten up. And he says there was a pizza delivery guy that got it instead of him. Like a guy, I think it was just on a bike. He was like on a motorcycle. And I said, one of my roommates or whatever saw that outside of Cardinal Gardens. I was like, was that where it was? He goes, yes, exactly. So like there's some similar stories there.
The things that keep hitting me watching the National Geographic documentary was how it would just, explode at an intersection, and you'd see people stopping like a half a block away and trying to figure out what the heck is going on in that intersection, and then realizing, I better make a U-turn and get the heck out of here and go anywhere, just not there. And you put yourself in those positions and think, here we're down there every day and thinking about what that must have been like, people trying to go home, and stuff is happening that you can't even imagine is happening right in the middle of intersections in these streets where you travel on every day. And you just see those cars stopping and then looking, people looking and then trying to figure out, maybe I better, and then they make a big U-turn and head the other way and hope they can, get out of there. But that's pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah. And, so I don't know, we'll do like a podcast that talks about it with different stories. I actually talked to the guy from the message board and, maybe get his sisters on, and, I can even have some of my, college friends. But if you were at USC at the time, or you were around there and had some stories, email me podcast@uscfootball.com, and maybe we'll put it together. I probably should have done this before the riots, but it just, once I posted those story, like those pictures and the stories started to come out, it just kind of got me thinking. I'm like, well, it might be interesting to kind of talk about it. 25 years is a long time, but man, it was crazy. And I remember we were, studying for finals. I was an engineering student. It was like, intense. It was really hard. We were driving to Kinko's and we had to make copies of a bunch of stuff. So there was four of us in this little car, and there's a lot of homeless people that were around, and we would see them all the time. And I used to do like can drive for the homeless when I was in school. Like, there was no like bad blood or anything, but I'll never forget, like, this was after the verdicts, something shifted, and we were outside of Kinko's on Figueroa. And some of the normal people, the homeless people we would see and talk to, there was a different air. There was a sense that, like, you could just tell there was a sense of empowerment there. Like, they knew something was going down. Like, you just kind of felt, it's hard to explain. I've never felt like that in my life. Something was happening and it was going to be bad. And we knew, we were like, we got to get back. And so we make the copies and we get back to the apartment, and you're just there, just riveting, trying to study, but watching on television. And not getting word that finals were canceled till like 2 a.m. and hearing random horror stories about buildings on campus burning, which was all untrue, just like rumors and stuff. But it was insane. And like, if your girlfriend's in another apartment, you're trying to call them. I called my mom, Dan, like that night, like, hey mom, I'm okay. She's in Boston on the East Coast. And she's like, I'm glad. Did you get your financial aid paperwork in? And I'm like, yeah. And then she like hung up or whatever. She had no idea what was going on. And the next morning she called, is frantic calling me like, what's going on? I'm like, mom, you were like, just blew me off. I told you like, we're, surviving the riots. And you're like, ask me about my financial aid paperwork. So I still remember it vividly, even though 25 years ago, obviously, because it was such a traumatic and crazy time.
I was back in Cincinnati, and basically, what you didn't pick up and that you do from the documentary is what was happening like at the Justice Center and how many people, you know, the threats there and, you know, how strong that was, you know, it wasn't just in the riot areas. And I don't think that got much coverage at all. And you saw the, you know, the outrage of, you know, thousands of people and the fact that there weren't enough police. You know, I don't know if there would have ever been enough anywhere. But there was a lot of that you didn't pick up, you know, if you weren't out here watching, you know, local LA TV, because there was just so much, that you couldn't convey all that to the rest of the country. So some of that was really shocking to me, that I didn't know, all of what was going on. And that was, pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah. Well, sorry.
I was thinking now, I mean, I know there are people who evaluate these things, and I know I've seen reports that the Figueroa Corridor from downtown to USC is the single most impactful urban development in the last 25 years in America. That there's no city, no place has done as much and has benefited as much from a single, you know, development as what's happened on the Figueroa Corridor out to USC. And clearly the biggest driver there has been USC, that there's no question that USC deserves credit for so much of what's happened after the riots in the last quarter century, that, you know, you just try to imagine how different Figueroa is from what it was like, you know, in 1992.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry again, we went a little bit long on the riot stuff, but it's just obviously it's important to me. And I know important to a lot of people at USC. Podcast at USCfootball.com. If you have a good story, let me know, or you can call us, 424-254-9141. And we'll move on, because there's another topic that it's kind of funny. We can't talk a lot about. But there were some interesting developments going on. It should be happening this week, Dan. Maybe give the latest update on the Coliseum renovation stuff.
Yeah, if you're a Trojan Athletic Fund a donor, or if you're a season ticket holder, you should be getting in the mail brochures and explanations and diagrams and charts and all the and it's embargoed for us until they're out. So they're in the process of being distributed, you know, to all those people. But it explains, you know, a lot's been going on, and we reported on a lot of, you know, the design and the, you know, the work that's gone into trying to get, you know, commitments for the founders suites and all the other things that, you know, that they're going to need to underwrite. As has been reported, the $270 million Coliseum project. But that's underway this week. We've got a big story ready to go as soon as the embargo is off. And, it's a kind of combination, a story and commentary, because it's hard to do one without the other when it comes to where it looks like the Coliseum is going and where the plans say it is going in the next 2 years. But there's going to be a lot happening in the next few days. And we hope you'll take a look at a very detailed, presentation of what's happening and how it's going to impact, everybody from, you know, the casual fan to, you know, the person who's a big time $10 million, you know, donor. There's a lot in there, and, you know, there's a lot that's going to be done to the Coliseum, that's very, very much needed, obviously, for probably a half century of deferred maintenance and renovation and all that kind of thing. And then there's some other design decisions that we've already questioned, so we're not, you know, telling anything out of school, but could be as soon as today, when this all when this all hits in terms of where we stand right now and where we're going and how we're going to get there in the Coliseum.
Yeah, unfortunately not a lot of positive news, I guess.
Well, there is positive stuff in terms of how the USC Athletic Department has approached this, and in terms of the fundraising part of it, in terms of getting support for it and all that. So I think from that standpoint, from the things that, you know, the athletic department has been able to control, I think they've done a very good job within the parameters that they have to operate. But to go into more than that might be, you know, telling more than I probably should tell. But
okay. We don't want you to do that.
It's kind of, we try to have a balanced approach, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand. Here's the good. Here's the what we'd like to have seen. And there are just differences of opinion, you know. We can look at it one way and somebody else can look at it another and say, you know, I think that's fine. And we could say, I don't think so. So
make sure you check it out. It should be this week whenever the embargo is lifted. Dan has a great piece going up, long one, a lot of details on that. Then if you have, I was kind of debating having you on later in the week, Dan, because then after the story comes out, but we could have you on again. We could do a special podcast just on that. We might need it. So I want you guys to read the story. You might get if you got a notification that your seat's moving or whatever, and you're happy, you're mad, let us know.
I can't go into those details yet. They won't get that level of specificity. What they will get is, this is how it's going to happen, when it's going to happen, and who it's going to have. I mean, I think this is probably not, breaking the embargo. It's going to happen to everybody. So it's a total approach to the Coliseum. So there won't be any one group that says, well, why us? Although there might be some who think why us more than others.
Yes.
You'll find it, I think, interesting as to how they're going to, you know, approach, the entire project from here on out.
Yeah, so definitely we'd love to do a reaction show. So if you're affected, I mean, obviously everyone's going to be, call us at 424-254-9141 or email us podcast@uscfootball.com and we'll be happy to talk with you about it and discuss it further once the embargo, is lifted, which right now it is not. So we can't go into too much more detail. So, we also want to talk about the draft a little bit, Dan. We had a question from Eddie, in Whittier. He's from Whittier, Richard Nixon town. He said, long time listener, first time writing in. And he texted this in. It's a long text message, but he texted this into our voicemail line. Question for Dan. As I sat down and watched parts of the NFL draft, I thought to myself, geez, what in the world is going on? This is not the first time our juniors go undrafted. He was talking about Damian Mama. There has been many, many players that have followed the same footsteps and fell short of the goal of being drafted. I think back there to the likes of Deion Bailey, George Uko, Xavier Grimble, George Farmer, Damian Mama, etc. With that being a trend of falling short, why is it that these guys continue to leave early? Why work so hard and unfortunately go undrafted? Like, what are these agents telling them or the coaches? I know ultimately it's their choice, but why do it if you're not for sure drafted like a Dory Jackson, Juju Smith, Suwage Cravens, Leonard Williams? Is the Matt Barkley decision still hurting these guys and making them think twice about staying? Can you please fill me in with both your thoughts? And as always, fight on. He says, wish these guys the best. He goes, P.S., wish these guys the best in the NFL. Eddie from Whittier.
Good question, Eddie. I would say this. Let's use the one example we have this year of Damian Mama. I do think, you know, agents can be very, positive in terms of what they think your outcome is going to be. And people who want to hear that, listen and kind of nod their heads. I know from what I understand, there were people telling him they thought he'd go in the first three rounds. Those were not people who were coaching at USC, I think from what I get, and try to have a little more on this in the war room, the best they thought would happen for Damian would be somewhere in the seventh round if things went well for him. It was really hard to overcome that 5.8840. You're the guy that the NFL Network shows over and over and over again running against Rich Eisen in the Run Rich Run part of the, you know, their NFL draft coverage. That's hard to overcome. And I think it made it hard. If you're a personnel guy at one of those NFL teams, it might be hard to put Damian's name out there. And so often the NFL does look for reasons not to draft you. I think Damian, you know, gave him some of those reasons. So I guess the other question though, and I know we always had this, you know, went by the standard that, you know, Pete enforced it, was if you're not going to be a first round pick or if you're not going to be the top guy at your position, you shouldn't go. Although I think you can look at it the other side. Had Damian stayed, would he be faster next year? I don't know that, you know, that that's the case. You know, there are times when kids are just ready to move on, you know, that school isn't the most important thing in their life. And, you know, seeing if they've got a career in the NFL is, and for them and their family, it's the decision. Now, would it have been the same decision if, you know, they would have gone into it saying, you know, if you're lucky, you're seventh round, but you could just as easily be unlucky. Does that change? You would think so, but maybe if you're really determined that this is what you want to do and you don't want to wait another year, you go ahead and do it. I mean, everybody's had different reasons. Like George Farmer, I think his thinking was he couldn't get insurance because of his injuries. And so had he come back to his senior year, got injured, you know, he'd have been out of luck. He figured, I think at this point, he figured, if I'm going to get injured, I might as well get injured in the NFL or trying to get into the NFL. And so I think that was a defensible way to look at it. And he's still kind of, you know, on the margins with Seattle and the practice squad and that as a running back now. So how that plays out for George, I don't know. You know, for some of the other guys, it's kind of played out or not played out. They've been around and they've gotten an earlier start. And I think mostly those guys have been coming back and getting their degree or trying to get their degree. I think if it's a decision where I'm not even going to try, I'm not close enough, the heck with the USC degree, then it's probably a really bad decision. But if it incorporates the ability to come back and get a degree, then I think you kind of got to let them make their own decision and give them the most information you can possibly give them, which I think in this case, the USC coaches did give him really good information that was absolutely on the money and wasn't enough to dissuade Damian.
We had, there was a couple other kind of questions along that same vein. Stephen Poway wanting to know, he thinks the NBA does a better job of providing information to these early enrollees. Could the NFL do a better job? And then Tarek wants to know, what can Clay Helton do to convince players and families the best option is to stay at USC?
Well, I think there's where a coach is kind of in the middle, because you don't, you know, if you push too hard, I think, for example, the case that always comes up is Pete Carroll and Mark Sanchez. And, you know, Mark's the highest, he's the quarterback that was taken higher than any quarterback in USC history. Did he need another year, or would it have benefited another year? I don't know. I mean, he might have benefited, and then maybe they would have, you know, not really gone all out as they did in his junior year four times, and the rest of the time they kind of played it safe. So would he have benefited from another year? I don't know. But you'd have been asking him to pass up some really, you know, the opportunity that he, you know, going as high as he did in the first round. Man, that's hard to and I think in that case, Pete came off as a little bit self-interested more than what's the best thing, you know, for Mark at that point in time. And you could make the case that asking him to come back was the best thing for Mark, but that's not how it came off. So I think coaches have to be careful in trying to, you know, I mean, this isn't Alabama, and it isn't one of those where you try to get everybody, you know, everybody has an obligation to come back, maybe in some people's worlds. But I think USC, you got to want what's best for the kid. And while you can make the case that Adoree, for example, could have come back, that has to be completely up to Adoree. What do I want? What's the best thing? Well, you know, do I love being in college and want my degree? And I'm not worried about my family will be fine and all of those things. That's what you want Adoree or Juju to make that decision. I know everybody, you know, talks about Juju being the youngest player in the draft. And is that a negative? Well, it becomes a positive when he gets that chance to negotiate that first free agent contract, when he's 24 or whatever. So, you know, he's starting his career, maybe be a little bit young now, although, as it turns out, he's the highest guy on the Steelers draft board, they tell us, in the second round. And so they obviously really, really like Juju for all the things they like. The Tennessee Titans really like Adoree for, you know, three things that they needed out of this draft, and Adoree gives them two. So they're really excited about Adoree. So for those guys, they went early, and it worked out for them. So, well, it's hard to know. I mean, Juju got drafted by the Steelers, and you talk about, does the NFL give them enough information? I think that's hard to know. I mean, Juju didn't have any, you know, workout with him, any personal meetings with him. He had the typical combine 15-minute interview, but he had no idea that the Steelers were going to draft him, you know, that he was that, you know, the highest guy left on their board in the second round. So I don't know how you guarantee that the NFL gives them enough information. If you went on the NFL.com website, where they have all the draft breakdowns and all the analysis and from all the scouts and all that, and you went there and looked up Damian Mama's bio or, you know, section, they would have told you he's, you know, fourth, fifth round. So, you know, were they wrong? Yeah. Can they keep those up to date? I don't know. If they'd have said, you know, seventh round or undrafted free agent, would that have changed things? Yeah, I think maybe. So how does the NFL get that kind of intelligence? Because a lot of the teams, they aren't going to want to tell you. And when they get down to those lower rounds, they really don't know, because they don't know who's going to be available and who's going to take who. I mean, who would have guessed probably that, say, Leon McQuay gets picked in the sixth round before Stevie, Tui Kalavatu, or that at all, or Justin Davis doesn't get picked at all. It's not a science exactly. And, how you make sure all those guys hear all, cause they're not just hearing from the USC coaches, they're hearing from their family and friends, and they're hearing from their agent. And there's a lot of voices in their heads as to, you know, what their value is and where they're going to go. And a lot of those voices are coming from people who really like them and really want them to do well and see all the good things about them. So it may not be all that easy to be really specific. And I'm trying to think, some of the USC wide receivers, if you went on the different boards where they evaluated everybody in the country who was eligible. And you could see a variance, like of a Darius Rogers, of like 100 positions. It's just wide receiver. You know, where one service would have him at number 55 and somebody else would have him at 170 or whatever. I mean, it's for absolutely certain not a science and not exact. And I don't know how you could make it any more, you know, absolute that these guys get the best information as to how the draft's going to turn out, because you just really don't know. I mean, there's just so many unknowables, and I think it was more difficult. Everybody who we talked to this year said this draft was more difficult to figure out than any they could remember. I mean, who would have thought last year that, you know, that the Rams would go the direction they did, or this year that the Bears would go for Mitch Trubisky and, like the Rams, trade up in order to get him at number two. And, you know, that's like one of those head-slapping moves that you just think, golly, how did that happen? Yeah. So, yeah. So I don't know we're ever going to be able to tell this kid specifically and absolutely this is where you're going. And if, you know, you just try to give him as much information as you can. But I'm not sure that anybody on the USC offensive staff had a good feeling about where Damian was going to go.
All right, let's move on there. Yeah, and like you said, there's some. It's not always that they want to come back to school. If there's, you know, there'd have to be overwhelming evidence that you're not going to get drafted, or even so, maybe it doesn't matter. You know, so I think in this case, it was something where Damian Wama, you know, didn't necessarily want to be in school anymore, and. And, you know, we'll see. If he makes a team, it'll work out fine for him. We saw Nickell Robey and stuff, you know, where people didn't get drafted and they made teams, or they got drafted late and it's worked out okay. A couple questions on the team, Dan, from Tarek. He wants to know first, do you think that since Deonte Burnett has the slot position locked down, that Steven Mitchell will get a look at one of the outside positions in the fall?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a lot of interchangeability available in this, you know, in their system. And I think, you know, they want the young guys to know all the positions. You have to expect that, you know, Steven does, and Steven wants to be on the field. So absolutely. Yeah. No, I think there's going to be mix and matching all over the place. And, I think that's going to be one of the features of this offense is they don't really want you to be able to know where everybody's going to be, or where they're going to be is going to signal what's coming. I think there's just going to be, I think they're going to have a real ability to, you know, kind of camouflage what they're doing and run different things with different people in different positions. So, I'm looking at that as a strength, especially with a guy who, if Steven, you know, comes all the way back from knee surgery, and with his, you know, experience, that he can do whatever they need him to do. And I think he'll be, thrilled to death to, you know, to get that chance.
He had one more about the running backs. He said with, Ronald Jones, Aka Cedric Ware, Vavai, Dominic Davis, if all those guys are healthy, would it be a good idea for Stephen Carr, the incoming freshman 5-star running back, to redshirt and learn the system so he doesn't have to burn a year where carries will be very limited?
See, I think it's overstated that you're going, by redshirting a kid as a freshman, you're going to get him for 5 years. I mean, my guess would be a player like an athlete like Stephen Carr, 4 years would be the max that you could possibly expect him to be at USC. So I don't think you're losing anything by playing him as much time as he deserves as a freshman. I know, you know, you can make the case for young offensive linemen who haven't grown into their bodies and really haven't developed and all that, but I always thought that those were the guys, or maybe quarterbacks when you got them in a, you know, 1-2-3 system, that are going to take some time. But I think for running backs, I don't know that a red shirt is something you really even want to think about. I do know this. They think Stephen Carr can do some things, especially as a receiver out of the backfield, that will elevate this offense, give them the ability to do things that they haven't been able to do. So I'd be a little surprised. That would probably be outthinking yourself if you did that. I would think that thought is not in anybody's mind, probably for sure not in Stephen's mind. And I don't see a red shirt possibility there at all.
One more on the team. Does Andrew Voorhees have a real shot at winning the right tackle spot over Clayton Johnston, or do you think Voorhees is considered a guard at this point? Thank you and fight on, Michael Elliott, class of USC 2005.
Hey, Michael, I don't know. I think he's got a shot at winning a spot somewhere or being really in the mix. Whether that's guard or tackle, I don't think maybe we know enough about him as a tackle. I think, you know, they felt pretty comfortable with him as a guard. So I don't know how that's going to play out. And I don't think those are the kinds of things that you can play out in your mind. I think those are the ones you just let happen on the field. And there are little differences in, you know, guard and tackle and exactly the offense that you're running now and in the pass game and the run game and lots of little things that until you actually see them play out, you really don't know. I mean, there are just little moves and little lateral ability to get from here to there that you have to see actually happen, you know, full speed. And I just think Andrew will be in the mix. He looks like he belongs. I like the way he looks in that offensive line. He looks like he belongs there. Exactly which position he looks like he belongs at, I think I'm going to let that play out over the summer, where he picks up, you know, the offense, and then the 29, you know, fall practices, and we'll see. But with the other freshmen coming in, you know, three or so of them who also are going to probably try to make a run at getting in the rotation, I think you have to play Andrew off against those as well as the more veteran guys and the guys, you know, coming back from surgery, like Toa and Nico and all of that. So he'll be there. He's a bonus. He is a guy who, when you looked at this class, I don't think you realized what kind of a player you were getting. That's an example of, you got to see them and they show up, and then you really have, you know, much better than what you've got on paper or what you've even got on video. And he's one of those guys that you think, wow, well, that's what a break there. This kid can play, and maybe right away. So I'm not going to pencil him in on any position, just in that offensive line somewhere.
All right, let's move on. We got Reggie in Seattle. He said, non-football related question. On the last podcast, you and Dan discussed limitations of scholarships for sports like baseball. My question is, although the schools are limited to 11 full scholarships and a few partial, not sure how many partial scholarships they can offer, but I'd like to know if these athletes can apply for other non-sports scholarships that most universities offer. For instance, if a benefactor sets up an academic or other scholarship at a school with the intent of the scholarship going to athletes, is this legal and does it occur? It would seem plausible that schools would simply try to ask these athletes to apply for a secondary scholarship set up for this reason. Fight on, Reggie.
Yeah, no, Reggie, it's not. You're right. Schools would do that in a heartbeat. You're allowed 11.7 in baseball, and that's just ridiculous considering you need about a 30-man roster. You know, for the number of games they play and number of pitchers they need and all of that. And you know, baseball probably has the worst deal of anybody, and that hurts USC probably more than anybody because they are surrounded by so many nationally competitive programs where it's a whole lot cheaper to, you know, if you split up a scholarship, which you're allowed to do in baseball, paying a half tuition or whatever at a, you know, at a Cal State Fullerton, a UC Irvine, a Long Beach State, a UCLA, even UC Riverside, you know, has had a pretty good program, UC Santa Barbara. Those schools, it's so much more difficult. And that's the difference between private school USC and, say, private school Vanderbilt or private school Rice, private school Stanford. Private school Stanford basically has an endowment that allows every student in school whose family has a family income of under $100,000, something like that, to be basically on full, tuition scholarship, kind of like the Ivy Leagues do it. And if you do it for the entire student body, then it's available to athletes and doesn't count as an athletic scholarship. But if it's something that you're already on an athletic scholarship or a partial scholarship, and then you get another scholarship on top of that, you have to, I think in most cases, that has to be considered as against the athletic limitations and grants. And I know long, long, long time ago, Kentucky basketball, when Adolph Rupp was starting a program that became kind of the first modern college basketball dynasty. And he had like 8 All-Americans on one team, 3 full teams that all 3 of them, 15 players, could have won the Southeastern Conference. A couple of them might have been able to win a national championship. And as it turned out, he had guys on there with tennis scholarships, and any sport you wanted. They had, scholarships more than the average team could have. And so they're not going to let you do that now. They're not going to let schools who maybe don't care about one sport to figure out a way to use those scholarships in another sport. So it's like, I think Randall, the Cunningham kid couldn't, even as a football player coming out of high school with Bishop Gorman, come in on a track scholarship. He couldn't play football for 2 years, or he would have had to have that count as against the football scholarship 85 limit. So yeah, they're pretty strict as far as the way they allow you to designate and break up and divide scholarships with other outside aid.
It kind of took me back down memory lane when I got all these scholarship questions and the sanctions hit. And basically the answer is always no. Nope, you can't do that. Like, well, could he put no? Like, would he? No, you can't do it. Like, so you have some idea? You have some idea that you could get another scholarship in for football? Yeah, you can't do that. So that was basically the answer.
Yeah.
One last topic about these. We had 2 questions about the massive ESPN layoffs that happened last week. I'll read them both to you and get your thoughts. First is Clayton, class of 2011. He said, in the wake of the massive ESPN layoffs, do you see this as a shift away from the giant broadcasting contracts? And if so, does this mean that USC and the Pac-12 have missed their opportunity to cash in on huge broadcasting contracts that the other conferences will benefit so much from? Thanks for all you guys do. You make following USC football so much more enjoyable. Great job on the podcast. So that's from Clayton. And then Stephen Poway wrote in, Dan, you talked a lot about the huge television contracts and other conferences have negotiated with the major networks like ESPN, Fox Sports, etc. Do the mass layoffs at ESPN call into question the long-term viability of those contracts? And if so, might the Pac-12 network approach prove to be a better system long-term? That's interesting. Just wondering. Thanks, Stephen Poway. So thanks for Clayton and Stephen, Steve, for those.
I mean, good questions. And Clayton and Stephen, I mean, who knows what Stephen just referenced is, the next Pac-12 contract doesn't come up till 2024-25. And, the Pac-12 was the first of the major conferences that got the chance to get they got the first bite of the apple. And they got the big hit up from where they had been, which was like nowhere, unfortunately, in the old days with Tom Hansen, a nice man, but not, really up on what could possibly be happening in college broadcast. So they got the big hit and it looked like, Larry Scott was this wizard and genius and blah, blah, blah. It was more a case that they were in the right place at the right time. now to have been basically, you know, supplanted by everybody else. So, you know, that the SEC and the Big Ten have just, you know, flown past them. The ACC, a little bit, the Big 12 right there for, you know, not nearly as good a product. And one wonders, where does this go down the road in terms of, you know, the big broadcast networks being able to handle this? I just think it's so far down the road. I mean, you know, USC, would they be better off, for example, trying to be the Notre Dame of the West Coast and trying to, you know, get a deal going with somebody like NBC and saying, well, you can have two games every Saturday, Notre Dame early and USC late, and try to work out one of those deals where you're, you know, in a conference for all the sports and you're half in it for football the way Notre Dame is with the ACC? I don't know. You know, I think there are a lot of, there are a whole lot of different ways to be looking at this, and USC better start looking at those ways, and the Pac-12 better start looking at those ways. I mean, is there a way that you can save it for, let's say, four, you know, 16-team super conferences where you have an East and a West and, you know, eight teams in each conference, and where you'd, you know, have a Pac-12 West or and a big, you know, the Big 12 provides you most of the East, and, you know, where you could incorporate Texas and Oklahoma, those schools on the East side, and you meet, you know, the, in effect, each conference's, conference championship is basically the first round of an 8-team college football playoff. I think there's so much that, that could be happening as a result of this. I know people say, you know, owning your own rights and having the ability to, you know, put the, put it out, you know, to, you know, people's cell phones and all their, you know, different devices. And I just, I don't know if that necessarily is the way this is all going to go, but I don't think anybody knows. And I'm almost thinking if the Pac-12 somehow, you know, stumbled onto the right answer, I'm not convinced they could, you know, they could carry out, you know, carry it out. And I don't know the viability of broadcast, you know, when it's going to, it seems like they're going to be scarcer and scarcer dollars for broadcast. And how viable are contracts where Oregon State and Washington State, you know, attract the same dollars as USC? I mean, is that long-term viable? I don't know. And is USC going to be happy with the situation where they're sharing equal dollars with programs much less expensive to run, with much, you know, much fewer demands and much less costly places to run them and all of that kind of thing? I think there are a lot of questions, and I don't think anybody has any really good answers right now. But I think that the key is to keep asking those questions and keep, you know, well, what if, and I don't think we know. I know this, ESPN knows that their model probably doesn't work, and that people aren't going to, you know, stay, you know, bundled and paying for, you know, ESPN as the, you know, the highest cost, you know, cable provider that, you know, on all the basic services if they don't watch sports. And it's also harder. For example, how do you make SportsCenter really viable for people who already know all the results? You know, 10, 15 years ago, everybody didn't know all the results, or they've seen all the highlights. I mean, you know, you go on Twitter, you can see the highlight play from the game you're interested in that's not the game you're at. When you get home, do you then want to sit down and watch SportsCenter? You've already seen, you know who won that other game or those other games. You've seen the highlight plays. What could they do on SportsCenter to make it that, you know, a value to you? ESPN's got a lot of things to think about. And, you know, the way their, you know, viewers are plummeting. And yet, I don't think their college football is necessarily the place where they want to take it out. I mean, if I'm ESPN, I'm looking at, say, the NBA, $1.5 billion NBA contract, and saying, what the hell were we thinking with that? But I don't think college football is in the same place. I don't think anybody looks at college football at the really top level college football and says, well, I don't think that's such a good deal. I think college football, obviously, and the NFL are, you know, the two places where cable could say, well, we don't have a lot of money, but this is where we can spend our money. I think those would be the two. Now, Major League Baseball and hockey and the NBA would be of less, I would think they would be, in the long-term future, maybe not have as good a future as college football. But the problem with college football is you have a number of programs who are really solid, locked in, and when they're good, everybody wants to watch them. But there are a lot of programs in college football that aren't in that same place. Where do they end up? How does this all work its way through? Man, I do not think we have any clue as to how that's going to happen. Just keep asking those questions, though.
Yeah, great questions, and we'll see. It's playing out right in front of us, and there's probably going to be more cuts. And you know, I don't know. My gut is that the Pac-12 missed a big window there, and we'll see. But they just made some bad decisions, in my opinion, and we'll have to see. But we're not going to know for years and years.
Yeah, I think the 12-year deal that they agreed to was probably not good. And
yeah.
And they shared it between ESPN and Fox shared it.
Yeah.
And basically, neither one wanted the other one to get it. And it was a decent amount of money at the time. So they basically said, okay, we'll take this on. Would USC have been better off if they would have gotten a sugar daddy like, you know, the SEC has with CBS? Or, you know, maybe, you know, or Notre Dame with NBC or... you know, I think probably ESPN has a better deal with, you know, the Big Ten and ACC, maybe, you know, and, you know, would they have been better off to have their own network affiliated with either ESPN or Fox instead of saying unaffiliated? Well, you know, it certainly seems to be helping the SEC. They've got their network with ESPN. They've got the connection with CBS, you know, SEC has two networks carrying their water. I'm not sure the Pac-12 has anybody carrying its water. And so, you know, you're already three time zones away. And, you know, with that, you know, geographic distance and time difference and all that, and then you're not connected the way, you know, the Big Ten is with Fox for their network, or the SEC is with ESPN. The Pac-12 is kind of on the outside looking in when some of this goes down, and USC can overcome that. I don't think there's any question. USC has the clout, the history, you know, all of that. That when USC is good, it doesn't matter what the Pac-12 situation is. But. What that does for USC, when the more you think about that, you say, well, it's because it's USC, not because it's the Pac-12. You know, you're not going to ever hear anybody chanting, you know, like they do, SEC, SEC. I don't think I've ever heard in my life a Pac-12 chant. I mean, you can't even figure out how to chant Pac-12 like SEC. But it isn't going to happen, you know. In the Pac-12, it's every man for himself. And USC really is coming from a place in college football where none of the others are. And so how does that play out? I don't know. But I think USC should, we say, you know, keep asking those questions. USC really has to be asking those questions of itself. Where do we go from here? What are the best solutions? How do we work this out? know, and not be afraid of the answers.
Yeah. All right, Dan. Well, man, a lot of different topics today. I told everyone it was a packed show. It certainly was, but great job. And thanks again for coming on.
Good questions. Thanks a lot for the questions. And catch that National Geographic documentary, everybody. I think it's really worth thinking about when you see those videos.
Yeah, it's a trip down memory lane for me, and definitely seen a lot of stuff I hadn't seen before. So good stuff. That's Dan Weber. Make sure you check him out on USCFootball.com, our great beat writer and columnist. I hope you guys enjoyed this show. Might try to squeak in another one this week. I'm going to head to a 7-on-7 tournament this afternoon, so maybe we'll do a little recruiting with Gerard. I'll have to get with him on that and see. But send us your questions in if you have any Riot stuff or whatever, anything. Send it to podcast@USCFootball.com, and we'd love to hear from you. So thanks. That's for Dan Weber. I'm Ryan Abraham. Thank you for tuning in to the Peristyle Podcast, and we will talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. Don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your smartphone or tablet for free. Just click the iTunes link on PeristylePodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.